somebody shimmied it around, it might not be 6 feet now, but.
Boundary agreements that the city has engaged in to renew or extend those agreements with neighboring communities. The importance of boundary agreements is just for orderly development, so that there's no confusion. When our corporate boundaries began to expand, or neighboring communities began to expand, with whose jurisdiction those unincorporated parcels will fall under. So the agreement that we have with Plainfield is pretty much staying the same. There's some old provisions in the agreement that no longer apply that were taken out, but in summary, the boundary agreement will remain with the boundary line being Grove Road. So it's from the township line all the way down to now it's extending down to Van Dyke Road. Previously it stopped about a little less than half of a mile to the north of Chicago Road. We decided to extend that terminus to be consistent with our Oswego boundary line. We've worked with the staff at Plainfield for the last couple of months on this agreement. We both agreed to remove a provision that has to do with facility planning areas. In the future, we don't have any that overlap, so there was language in there that we would object to any like CMAP of facility planning projects, and we don't see us having any issue with that in the future. There was a provision in regards to groundwater protection. We all both have adopted ordinances, so that no longer applies. And then the last section in the original agreement that we're proposing to remove is the language that dictates contribution towards roadway improvements and construction of road. The county itself has its plan improvements to road. A portion of that would be within this area, so 126. But they're moving forward with it. Grove Road is a county road, and we both plan to have language in the annexation agreement that addresses any improvements to Grove Road development. So if you're in consensus with moving this forward, staff plans to publish a hearing notice on October 16th, Beacon newspaper for November 10th, City Council public hearing. And if you have any questions, I'm here to answer.
How is this different than the Sugar Grove agreement that we did a year and a half ago? This is pretty much the same thing, just a bit more depth because there's less stuff out there, right?
So if I hear the question correct, is it different from Sugar Grove? Most of the language is pretty standard in both of those agreements. This was the only agreement that had that unique language that referred to not filing any formal objection if a CMAP or any governing body had propose any future planning area amendments. But other than that, they're pretty standard in the plan.
Cool. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Results of the survey, the respondents were also split 50-50. regards to interest in raising chickens in the backyard, but an overwhelming percentage said, about 68%, they were okay with their neighbor having the ability to do that as long as it was clean and regulated by the city. So based on the HOA covenants, and I didn't gloss over this, but in the survey also there was respondents saying they had a preference for either large lots having the ability to raise chickens, as well as the 12,000 square foot, typical R2 lots. So that was it as well, and the consensus was a small flock of chickens, about 3 to 4. So based off of covenants being split 50-50, as well as the respondents being in support of residential chickens and opposed being 50-50, staff has no specific direction that we want to propose. We're asking for feedback from the team on how to proceed.
So I guess
nobody really has an opinion for or against sitting in here. And like, I'm all for allowing people to kind of explore their options, but I want to make sure that we're not only protecting Pete from having to run out of chicken stuff. But if we do allow something like this, I'm thinking about those houses on 47, like the two-flex, or however we call them. Those lots are obviously too small, because you can literally reach out somebody's window and borrow a toothpick. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't want to have this type of situation where we've got people in close proximity, and now there's freaking chickens. While I understand people's, you know, interest in trying new things, this is something where I'm still concerned about the novelty phase. And maybe, as opposed to having a permit fee that is, you know, expensive, we have somewhat of a deposit, so that if there is a call for service, well, if you've lost interest in this, and we do have to send Pete out to inspect it because you've let your chickens run amok, whatever that might be, maybe as opposed to charging a higher fee if you don't, you know, call for backup, because, you know, Pete's going to come out with his chicken outfit. If you don't have to call for services, there's no complaints against you, you get that money back once your chickens are gone. I'm just trying to look at this from a perspective that isn't so, you know, labor heavy on Pete, and then we have to scramble and come up with new regulations for chickens when we never had them when one person asked for it. But again, we've already kind of done this research, we understand what the options are, but nobody has an opinion. 50-50 on literally everything. And then now, at least in my neighborhood, the amount of coyote noises and owl noises are kind of concerning, because now it's not just they're going after small dogs and small children. Now they're going to go after your chickens. So these are all things that we should be kind of, you know, considering. And from my perspective, since there is no great public interest, I mean, do we know how many responses we got on the survey?
Yes. We did not gatekeep it at all, so there was no way to tell who was in city limits and who wasn't, or was, you know, a pro group and an anti group. There were like 550 responses, so we got more on that than we did for our gatekeep city services survey that we did last year. So yeah, so that's the number. Got very high responses.
I think Joel just said, here's another thing. People are into this hobby chickens, the one I talk, but it's not commercial. I know what that's like. Hobby chickens, they're going to let their chickens go in the yard. They believe in free things. Okay? So, first time somebody's chicken pops, flies over to the neighbors and meets the bird feeder, you're going to have an issue. I can just tell you that right now. Especially if it's on a small lot. Because they will fly up on that and eat the bird seed that's for birds in your neighbor's house. It's just natural.
You know what's something you made a good statement? No one's, I agree with you, no one I thought was passionate about this. Most of the people I talked to were like, you're like, what? You have to put on chickens? So like,
yeah, when I got involved in beekeeping before I was that for that time, I was passionate because I had made an investment and I was a couple thousand dollars in. I'm like, hey, this is something that I'm really passionate about, I want to do something with it. There was no easy out, you know, after the 10th near-death experience. Yes, it was easy out, but at that beginning stage, I had made the investment, I had taken the classes, I had literally, you know, mentored underneath people, been free labor for a couple of years for a number of different beekeepers, just to kind of get my feet wet. Here is, you can drive out to, rural game,
yep,
and pick up a couple of chickens,
for about my
chickens. There's nobody stopping you from buying your chicken. Which, this is America, darn it, you should be able to buy chicken wherever you want. I just don't see them being something that somebody's going to come at us and say, please, let me have the chickens. Now that we know that we have the option, that okay, it's going to be the groundwork, it's like the hard, heavy lifting is over, but we still don't have anybody coming and saying, hey, I want to raise chickens. And if they do, they don't live here. So I think the answer is kind of, since there is no consensus and there is no answer, what's the point?
You just said that they don't live here.
Yeah, you got your one lady, yeah, sure.
I have four residents.
Four residents?
That going to be?
The chicken consortium of the third ward. None of their comments have ever been shared. So it's like, if they're just in person, cool, let's find out more about
details.
It's like, all right, we've got 550 responses, and we all know that you can respond to it over and over and over again. I just thought that the results would be more skewed in one way or the other. Because I honestly thought this was going to be like a NIMBY thing, like, oh, not in my backyard. It's the opposite. It's
so
like,
sure.
That's what happened.
Right.
Bart, was there a one-time only
really imply. So then they could just click on that link and start saying, oh yes, we want this or we don't. I would echo the same concerns as Joel and Ken in that I think we said that originally, like, I would like to see a little bit bigger lots, personally. I have friends and family that live next to chickens, and it gets messy, it's smelly. What do they do with the dead chickens? They throw it in the back corner. What do they do with the rotten eggs? They throw it in the back corner. There's a lot of little nuances like that that can really be a nuisance. I mean, again, I would love to hear the positives and why people would want it other than we would just like that chicken. You know, if there are some details involved, then maybe I would consider it differently. But the healthy discussions we had locally with, you know, friends and neighborhood stuff, obviously my children, you can't have it anyway, but they were worried about varmints and critters because we lost a dog across the street from my house from an eagle. And the dog was this big. It was right next to the owner's foot, swooped down, grabbed it, and took off. So you can imagine we hear coyotes as well. Coyotes, they know that there's chickens. They have a memory. They keep coming back. Same thing with what they call raptors, eagles, hawks, etc. And that can be something that's a big nuisance too. So I mean, when you consider all that, you know, I'm kind of the same thing for you guys.
The other thing that I think we're talking about egg-laying chickens, right?
Theoretically.
I thought theoretically there was no meat chickens. Because there's a difference, a huge difference.
Well, we haven't drafted anything yet, so.
So someone that's raising these for food, which, first of all, you're not going to raise just four for that. You're going to raise 20, 30, you're going to buy 20, 30 pizza in the carton. So, we're talking, it's like a pet almost, and I just don't know if that's.
Can I just do a straw poll? Did you?
Nay.
Just on people reaching out, did anyone reach out to you?
I think we had, didn't we have somebody email everybody separately?
But just like, did anyone call you?
No, no.
Does that,
you're the only one, unless you're taking
a big call. Well, when I shared the survey, I had like 20
ha-ha's.
Yeah, when I put it on
Facebook,
my little
Facebook. Yeah. When you mentioned it, Jackie, when you mentioned it, then I'm
kidding,
but.
No. But most of them were not.
I think the ones that I heard that were positives, when the discussion began, they started talking about the different nuisances, then they were like, wait a minute, okay, I see what you're saying. Probably not.
So what do we
want to
do with this? Do we want
to take
further, or just... So now
it's a problem.
You said
name. Right. I'm quite nameless with a very huge slot, which takes out most.
I'm a man, but like, just like with all the stuff that either I brought forward or people that I'm communicating with in the city, it's something somebody's passionate about. Well, let's hear the positives and negatives. We know there is no positive opinion and there's really no negative opinion. There's only the kind of fears that we have.
We can't know one come here, so.
So, like, Chris, if you've got four neighbors that want to do it, like, let's. It's almost like you have to kind of build it and then they'll come. So, if we're going to do this, first, we got to find out how big their lots are, what they are already invested in this. Is there a chicken education course that we should be considering? Like, these are all the things. Like, I'm dead serious. So we talked about beekeeping. You had to have some sort of knowledge of the care of these, you know, sentient beings. So I just don't want to say, yeah, chickens are cool. But we already know that emotional support chickens are allowed under your cookbook. But you can't eat their eggs. Okay, so if somebody wants a chicken as a pet, they can still do that, but they can't be outside. So if that's that, are they looking for this for, you know, eggs? Are they looking for this for hours? It's an emotional support chicken.
So the ones I'm talking, or the ones I'm talking to, they're not looking for meat, they're looking for pets. They want to be able to raise them, they want to be able to, you know, teach their kids, be self-sufficient. Granted, it's a little expensive to get that going, but, you know, they're interested. I mean, it's very much like the beekeeping. You know, we had an interested party, you know, wanting to do it. So we got into it, we looked into it, researched it. Now that one, we didn't do a community survey. I mean, here we got 500 people who chimed in. Right, we don't know exactly where they're from. Right. And we got another 20% of those, you know, 35% saying, yeah, we're all in. 20% or 25% saying, hey, you need a little more research. You know, and then the others are, no. So it's, you got a majority that are truly on the yes or
we don't know, honestly. I really don't know much about it. Yeah, to Joel's point, yeah, I mean, if we knew more details, we knew exactly why and had more positive, but I think it'd be an easier decision. You know, until then, I'm just kind of, like they said, back.
Trust me, with the EU, I wasn't all in favor for that. I got a daughter who is severely allergic to it. But, you know, I know the benefits of what they do. Now, we went with that, they charged to do that. We didn't have a whole lot of success with it. I mean, we had a couple of deep permits pulled for it. Not so much because they didn't last very long. But we went with that one. This one, you know, we got some residents interested. I'd like to see, maybe there's an opportunity. So are you guys saying that you want to see more feedback from the residents?
Yeah.
Is that
why we should do it?
Yeah, the Chicken Coalition of the Third Ward. We should have actual information from people in the area that is specific, and we can, you know, document that they are from the area. That yes, I'm interested in that kind of chickens, and this is where I want to.
So
if I can just say one thing, the survey did have a question on what was the interest in those who wanted the chickens, and it was about 87% said they wanted them for the eggs, while those that were opposed to it, their biggest concern was the appearance and the noise and the disease, but overwhelmingly wanted them for the eggs, and then the other interest was as a pet or educational activity.
So you get an egg every other day. Roughly. Now, commercially, you get 90%, that's the way you do it. But probably these chickens, so what, 4 chickens? You might get a dozen a week at the best scenario.
Well, and I'm just wondering, you know, when if that happens, and then that people don't get the results, what are you going to do with chickens?
Now, with this permitting process, will there be like permission for the inspector to actually enter the property? That's something that if you're going to have chickens that are 4 eggs in Yorkville, you have to basically sign off on the fact that you're going to be inspected and somebody's going to come to your property and check out your chickens.
It could be. We've not gone that far yet.
That's going to be a problem. We have a lot of those complaints anyways that are rear yard. If the complaint's not from an adjacent neighbor or someone directly behind them, we're only allowed to enter the city-owned properties. We can walk the county back to the front door and knock on the door, and if they get calls to know our chickens go away, plus we can see it from the city street, or else a neighbor says, yeah, come in my backyard and pound my deck and look over the fence. You know what? That's fine. But we can't even, if there's a city even, we can't even peek over a fence. So, like a beekeeper, we have the right to go back there and check out the hives where the bees are.
Right.
So, yeah, it's going to be a headache for you.
Unless it's strictly written.
Right. Beekeeping was written right to a lot. So,
just think about every bad situation and then times it by 2, and that's when you write the regulation for us. But since there is no real feedback from someone I know doesn't work besides the Chicken Coalition of the Third Ward, if we're going to do anything with it, I'd like to kind of just have that feedback. What are your intentions? How many are you thinking? How big is your yard? All these things. But then also make sure that if this is something we do, we're not putting feet out there to, again, go take a class on chickens, get all your chicken boots, and then make it his problem. I want to make sure that we're not covering our bases and not making this there. But then again, we've already spent 3 months talking about chickens.
And then if we do something like that, do you have to seek permission of the adjacent properties to make sure they're okay with it too?
I think that has to be a must.
I mean, obviously, so depends on the change.
You discussed that with the beekeeping ordinance, and I believe that it was not consent. I think it was just notification.
Yeah, notification, not consent.
Okay.
Then again, I don't know many people who are allergic to chickens.
Right.
Nor are chickens flying around and attacking people and their venom causing people to go in and collect a shot. So I mean, that's the one benefit of chickens is that they can't sting you.
You know,
that's what, you know, it'd be nice to get more detail about, hey, I'm going to put a privacy fence up so we can
see it. Now you know they're there, they don't make much noise, that sort of thing. I mean,
so what do we want to do?
We're going to kick the chickens next month, and then Uncle is going to talk to the Chicken Coalition on the third floor. And yes.
Right now, I haven't heard enough to.
Yeah,
third, second, and first. Okay.
Yes. Again, I think staff's not enough. We've got good details, but it's like knowing, all right, what are their intentions? And that's all right, well, now what do we think? And then we can have
that. They just need to get the sample through all this and write all this all up. And,
right.
And get four people in on chickens.
Right. No, I agree. That's the part.
There's a lot of work.
And we've done worse.
It's true.
We've done a lot. All right,
so we want to just move this to next month then?
Yep, I think staff's done enough. Now it's just
time. I would have less staff to do.
People want chickens.
No more work for staff.
Reach out.
I'm going to talk about chickens. All right, let's go on to Old Business 2, EDC 2020-42, Limited Manufacturing Uses in Residential.
Okay, so upon the direction from EDC last month, staff did some exhaustive research on this matter, and you see that in the memo, but I'll break it down to you in a couple of steps. First, we started out on the premise that there are three possible options that the city could take. One being that we would allow the manufacturer of firearms as a permitted home occupation, so we would have to amend the zoning. Second option is to amend the zoning ordinance to allow that use as a special use in residential zoning districts. Or three, keep the code as is and allow the manufactured firearms to manufacturing districts. So that last meeting, we were asked to verify with the city attorney if non-home rule municipalities can require a license or registration for firearms manufacturing as a home occupation. We found out that we can do either a registration, I think this was the recommendation though. And the second thing was, if we did identify it as a home occupation, I mean, this is some kind of criteria for that. So staff, we went back to square one and talked with the petition, the impetus for this petition was Mr. Vander, and asked him to give us more specific on how it's operational. So in the memo, you see, you know, what his type of work really consists of, the percent of destruction and disassembling, the evidence of firearms and police agency, and then he does have a sales component to it as well. Then you go on a little bit further, and we looked into the state-approved public act that's addressing illegal gun trafficking, and a lot of that's included in your packet, but a lot of those provisions apply to retail as in stores or anything that's open to the public. So there are provisions there for video surveillance, there's provisions for locations near existing schools or preschools, and also provisions for annual inspections, and that's the state's rule. And then we looked at what the ATF does. So in your packet, there's information on how you get approved for a federal firearms license. And even though it seems like it's an exhaustive process, it's a 60-day turnaround from the date you submit your application to when you get approved. And then after that, they may or may not conduct the annual inspection, and your license is good for 3 years. And according to the ATF on their website, fiscal year 2017, they had about 135 FFL licenses, 135,000 federal firearm licenses issued. And in that same year, they did about 11,000 compliance inspections. So they were hitting less than 10% of who they issued to do those compliance inspections. And if the ATF does find a violation, they don't immediately revoke the license. They do try to find ways to educate the license holder and get some voluntary compliance. So even if there's a violation, there's not necessarily any operation stops. There are 9 types of FFL licenses. They range from dealers to manufacturers to importers to others. And the licenses seem to be cumulative. So if you get a type 1, which is a dealer, which you can sell, that's what you can do. If you get a type 7, which means you can And you can move them between those activities throughout your 3 years if you have a license. So staff did look at home occupation, what we could regulate, and what we would feel comfortable with if that was the direction of the city council. We have some draft language in there. And basically, the language stipulates that the operation has to meet all of the original criteria, which is not to exceed the floor area 25%, doesn't generate any traffic, and the goods on site. But again, these types of things are hard to regulate because you don't get a certificate for a home occupation from the city. It's just these are the regulations. You can have this operation in your home, and it's kind of an honor system until we get a complaint that we can then investigate. And then last but not least, staff did an analysis of the three types of options that we have available. And we found that the most regulatory ability that we have is to keep the ordinance as is in manufacturing, because we can regulate a lot of those things, traffic, parking, surveillance. You can require that in a commercial setting, whereas a home setting, we don't have that ability to strongly regulate that. In the special use process, you have a little bit more of ability to regulate that. But again, once it's operating in the house, you kind of locked in unless you have some very good ability to justify that it's not meeting that particular requirement for, you know, traffic, people having coming and going, increasing traffic, things of that nature. So staff is looking for direction from the city council based off all of this information that we were able to provide you. In your packet, there's information on different licensing, the application process, and there was a concern expressed at one point about burglaries of these types of locations, and the ATF does provide a map and an infographic on that from its most recent data collection. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but we're looking for a direction of how you want us to move forward with this.
Comments? Questions?
Well, it seems like the easy answer is to keep them in the manufacturer districts and see if we can control them or stuff like that. I don't think home occupation makes sense at all, because like you said, whenever I hear honor system, I know half the people who say, oh yeah, my honor are half-assed. So knowing that this is not specific to Todd, that I don't think anything that I'm concerned with has anything to do with him. But I always kind of go back to, if him, then everyone else. We're basically making the case for allowing this type of activity. And we can't use his character, his reputation, and what I know about him personally and professionally is that he would not be the type of person we're trying to protect the neighbors from. I also don't think he would have a problem adhering to all of the requirements of the home occupation, 25%, doing based on all that stuff. I don't think he would be having retail sales going on. I don't think there'd be any bangs or any booms. But again, I'm not worried about him. I'm worried about the other people. So from my perspective, if anything, it makes sense to keep it the same with all of these justifications. But I'm a hard no on home occupation.
I wish I'd be okay with it, but I wish it was some way of working that, you know, an organization with the city that we can keep tabs on, like Joel just said, with people. So that's what I'd like to see, is that some kind of registration with the city or somewhere where there's contact on who's doing it in the basement and let me know.
You had asked that at the last meeting, and I did ask Kathy. I don't think I got anything in writing from her, and I believe her verbal answer was that there is no license like that. So anything you can do would be registration-based. So the proposal from Christy is basically to do it as a special use type of request. So in that case, you know, the license is the special use authorization. There's an ordinance, there's a public record on it, you know who it is. You know, there's public input taken at the start of it, and once the authorization is given, you know, then it's given. So, you know, some of the licensing type questions and registration, you might be able to shoehorn into a special use process. Maybe not background checks and some of those other things that are already part of the FFL process. But nothing, you know, straight license, you can do this, you know, and it's in code.
But then you would
have to apply to the city. You'd have to go through a public hearing process, notification, city council approval, get an ordinance.
Is that once a year renewal type thing where they come to the city and renew?
Our special use authorizations typically sunset after 5 years. Looking for Christy.
No, it doesn't expire. So it stays with the use until the use is discontinued. It can be revoked if for a violation of any of the conditions, and it can also be revoked if you are approved your special use operation, but you never start it after the reviews.
But isn't he already going to be registered with the state police and the ATF, so then this would just...
Yes.
Why would we want to go spend more staff time doing that if it's already done by the state and the federal level?
Well, to that point, I mean, we do state level background checks for liquor licensees, and we do local checks. So it's not out of the question to do that double time.
Yeah, I think the process for the ATF, my dad was in FFL for a while, and that took a while. I mean, you're not going to, it's just like the chicken conversation. You're not, if you have to get an ATF and not a state background check to raise chicken, ain't nobody raising chicken anymore. So knowing that that process is, awesome. The only concern that I have, taking into account the fact that kind of answers a whole bunch of concerns, the only thing that is a concern is the fact that isn't your FFL considered cumulative? So if you have 7, that means that you have 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. So you can't do the explosive devices with a lot of 7. That's what it
is. Well, it's not, I don't think he's just an FFL. He's a couple steps up.
Well, no, he's got the menu, he's got the FFL right. Level 7.
So if you have that, it's not like, you know, yes, there's a lot of FFLs around, but this is several steps above that, so it's even more difficult to obtain.
Kind of like, to answer your question, an old one is a retail license. An old two is more of a gunsmith or something like that. Old three is a collector, which is usually issued to civilians. O6 is ammunition manufacturing license. Ammunition manufacturing is considered separate from firearms manufacturing. What the O7 allows you to do is it allows you to deal with the manufacturing of firearms, gunsmithing, and or retail sales. That's the cumulative effect because the way the ATF is now interpreted certain gunsmithing rules. That if you change the firearm by more than X percent, you consider that a manufacturing operation, and therefore want you to have a manufacturing license. So the cumulative effect there is more about gunsmithing and other things like that than it is to, ammunition stuff. And I think the way the proposal about which was drafted would prohibit the use of all 6 licenses in NRS area, which can comply with all requirements on the existing, home business restrictions. The thing is, not only do I have a federal license, now I have to register and comply with the state. The only thing I think staff missed was that their consideration of retail is not simply somebody who is open to business like a Dick's or RKA. You make any transfer to a non-licensed individual, and this is a private party, not somebody who's an FFL, you fall into the retail category of all of those add-ons within the statute plot. So if you transfer one firearm, and we do transfer firearms from time to time, retail sales is not at 2% or 4% of the business, if anything. That's what it is. I answered the question you guys have just so you got for him, but I have to have state license, I have to have a federal license, and I have to have a FOIA card, which means I will do 360 background checks because they run my FOIA card against the criminal records index every single night except major holidays to see if I've been arrested or once I'm an issue or during the DHS mental health database for.
I think it's like 15 minutes, right? It goes that length. At least the line was like 15 minutes, they said.
Well, if you're running background checks on individuals for transfer, which the system in Illinois is called FTIC, our own transfer inquiry program, that we have to run when somebody wants to buy or transfer a firearm, I've got an individual that's waiting on the case. Because the system is so backed up because of the federal system and the sales on firearms in the Illinois system. It just can't
handle. So, quick clarifier on FFL, when you're talking about retail sales, saying that your business is 2-4% retail sales, transfers aren't retail sales because somebody else is making the money in a different type of transaction. You just take a fee for your transfer note, receiving it, signing it over, running a background check, and getting it to them, right?
Yes, but if the state of Illinois considers any transfer on a 4473 to be a retail transaction, whether or not it's typically simply a transfer or it's an actual commission on selling firearms. We don't stop firearms for sale.
Right. So I guess what I'm getting at is the concern over here about the ability to effectively regulate increased vehicular traffic and or parking. You're not having people coming in and browsing.
Okay.
This is something where there is an item somebody else has. In that essence, it's a transfer, but still be considered retail sales.
Firearms were in Alaska, they were driving home, they could not drive through Canada with the firearms. They had to ship them to Illinois so he could effectively take possession of his firearms. We've done this before. We do transfer because people buy something over the internet. The traffic in and out of my house generally is going to be less than if somebody has a party there once a month. We just really don't, like I said, I think the number says we've doubled 300 transfers. That's everything going up over the last 6 years. That, and I don't see any fluctuation in that change. It's not normal business.
So, and then to take into consideration the procedures that you kind of adhere to as an FFL in the state of Illinois, you have almost consistent or every time there is a transfer or a sale, there is reporting that's going to these outside agencies, correct?
We are the custodians for 4473. There is a record that's kept in the state police, the background check was called in. There is no national registration of firearms. That's what 4473 effectively is. But it is a record of ATF that we are simply the custodians of. If and when we surrender our license or go out of business, then we have to turn all those records over to the ATF. And there's two records. There's a bound book, which is all of the ins and outs. Gun comes in, where you come from, gun goes out, who you go to. And then you have the 4473 for everything that's retail. Because of the bound book, we would keep, so I transfer a firearm to another people. It's going out of state, they bought it, they did whatever. That won't be on 4473, but there's a record. With the 4473, there's this disposition of a firearm to a non-licensee, targeting the individual. So there are those records that are inspected, and the one that's been in the statute for over 35 years that says our old law books are inspectable by local police departments upon request. State law allows local police departments to come in and inspect our books on our premises under the current law. So your local village has some, and as much as I don't want a third license, there are no municipalities around who have special licenses. Most of them are all in Cook County, because Cook County passed the gun rules ordinance as a county ordinance, but the whole rule comes within there. Gunshots decided they were going to regulate and not the county. I don't see any proposal within state law that explains several other towns in Cook County that look at that way. They have done something. So.
I'm for the special.
Yeah, well, just knowing that we already have these checks in place, we've already got, you know, he's vetted through and through between the state and federal government. When there are transactions that have to do with making sure that someone passes the background check by entering the phone system, whatever, that takes place. It's just making sure that we have ample authority to be able to enforce the no man's no rules. You're not having people walking off the street. There's not a showroom. Knowing that the police department has, you know, if need to, they can, you know, inspect that book. Again, my main concerns aren't with you or your type of business, but it's trying to define what that business is in a way that's a bunch of check boxes, so it's idiot-proof. And I think we've got the kind of authority thing kind of figured out as far as the state and the federal government are concerned. But I don't think that my concerns are enough to kind of stop the discussion on special use, since what we're essentially talking about is writing it, kind of like chickens, writing it to what you need to be able to perform your business, but not in a way that makes it seem like anyone and their mom can get this license and be selling, you know, bangs and booms out of the garage. So what I'm hoping that we can kind of, I want to dumb this down a little bit so that it is the check boxes. Knowing that a lot of it's going to be redundant since you've already gone through the FFL process with the ATF and the federal or the state government, it's just we have to have reassurances like all along the way, and that's, you know, I'm always out my big guy on optics. If it looks like nobody's opposing it, but there's no discussion on it, why is it that way? Is it nobody has an opinion? This is something where it's important. This is your livelihood. It's what you do. Provide a service to not only police departments, but to people all over that are, you know, avid about this type of hobby. And I'm cool with it. I mean, like I said, I've got family members that are heavily involved in this, but again, they're not doing that work at home. So it's making sure that as we have this checklist for the special use, that there are assurances all along the way that this isn't any just Tom, Dick, or Harry getting the permission to do whatever the hell they want in their basement. This is a federal license, state permission, background checks every, you said, 360 days a year, whatever. That's information that needs to be consistently delivered. However, this is kind of a package. So that's, like, yes, I can for sure, I'm far more agreeable to a special use than anything about getting the home application.
Yeah. Okay. So, the special use will kill this altogether. If we go special use, there's no reason I'm making a change to the book. The fee for a special use permit the process of taking this out to a public hearing will kill this absolutely. Because if you go out and you do a public hearing that says, hey, I'm going to manufacture guns in my basement, the whole entire neighborhood that's been notified with our notification, plus the fact that it's been published, you're going to get people across the city come out and say, oh my gosh, I'm against guns, not going to happen. They're going to read them the right way. So, trying to be small business friendly, which is what this is, says that going to a public hearing for a special use, this will, no one will do it. Don't care. Because people come out to complain. They don't come out to support almost anyone. You know, let's go back to chickens. Nobody came out in support. Let's go back to Kendall Marketplace with the townhomes. Nobody came out in support. When's the last time you've really seen somebody come out of support? It does happen. So if you open this up to a discussion of, I want to do something in my own basement, as a business that I'm already doing somewhere else, I'm regulated and licensed somewhere else to do it, i.e. the manufacturing district, but I want to do it in my own home, you're going to get people that are going to say, no, I don't want that. Not in my backyard. So what we're talking about is we want to be small business friendly for somebody or some persons in a community that want to do something that they're already licensed for, or can get licensed for, very, very strictly. Because this person that is here, Don, is already licensed to do exactly what he's doing somewhere else. But due to the cost of rent and the different factors, one materials in their basements and in their garages. This is something that would have rules and conditions on it as a home occupation. That's where I would consider a home occupation, because this is something that, like I said, already regulated, state and federal. They're licensed for it. They've been doing this. There are checks and balances. We're just looking, can we or would we be small business friendly? If we keep it in the manufacturing business district, it is what it is. We see there are any others that will do it. Looking at the FFL licensing, there's several that are in their neighborhoods already. We've got several in business districts right now in manufacturing. So there are people that could easily go ahead and do this if they wanted to, because they would have the licensing to do it. There are not many of them. So I would consider hearing the option of home occupation. That's really what we're trying to get to. We have to regulate it through a registration. A license, because that's an outlaw. So you can do a business registration. I don't know if we can pull information from the state or the FFL licensing to say, hey, yes, you have it. Maybe with the registration, we say that you captured the last copy of your information, so we know that everything's up to date. But these are things that if somebody's going to have this type of license from the state to federal, they know what they're doing. They're not a fly-by-night type of we know that there are requirements for security and protocols in place from other levels that we can't enforce. So it's by no means fly by night for somebody that's not going to do something like that. In fact, anything that you do for manufacturing, if you take in something from the police department that is for destruction, you have to log and manage all of that. So pretty much everything that he is going to do, or anybody under this, has a regulation and a law at some level, whether state or federal, for everything coming in and going out. So we may not be the controlling entity on it, but it's not a willy-nilly free-for-all operation by no means, because this is something that's been going on in other districts. It's just, are we small business friendly for someone who wants to do this at a small scale individual? We're not talking about bringing in a big CNC machine. This is, you gotta get, whatever you're doing, you gotta get in the basement. So, I don't know anybody who can, without doing massive construction, get more equipment out of the basement. So we're not talking, you know, a platform welder that's gonna do something that's, you know, 4 foot by 4 foot. You're doing small pieces. So, and like you said, 300 transactions a year, that's not very much. I see more Amazon trucks going to some of my neighbors. I had to see 300 shipments in a month at some of these places. So,
all that being said, taking into account not only Todd's reputation and his history, and understanding that what he does is a valued service, not negating any of that, but when you talk about the reason why it shouldn't be special use is because other people will kill it, that's why you should make it a point to have those, and that's what I was saying. This has to be idiot-proof, because you need to be explaining to people, what you do is this, and this is why I should be allowed to do it. If somebody said, hey, they're going to allow this guy to build guns in his basement, you say it like that, heck no, I don't need to be my neighbor.
Well,
yeah, like, so like, that's just clear as day. So it's all in, if the delivery is the issue, the delivery isn't the issue. It's the fact that you're not perfecting the delivery. So if this is something that we want to do, and special use is the comfortable option, because it gives us more preparation time. It doesn't allow these things to kind of fly through. The idea that there'd be a fly-by-night FFL is a stretch to imagine. I get that. But to not give a neighbor input on something that they could consider potentially out of bounds when they initially moved in their neighborhood is something that I think we should be allowing people to have the right to know.
How is this out of bounds? I'm beekeeping is out of bounds now for something.
Yeah, because you had to get your neighbor had moved, and how is it you told them?
Right. So
that's part of the special, like, that's part of the
but when you're creating regulation, there's no report. I mean, this is small business. I mean, we have people doing things that are far worse than what this would be.
Understood.
Because people are doing things in the basement, making projects that have no regulation whatsoever. Buying and selling, manufacturing, doing things that there's no one looking over. You know, materials are coming in and out, the houses in and out of neighborhoods. Highly caustic, toxic, whatever they might be, growing materials that shouldn't be there, but it's done. This is something that is
respecting your neighbors. How do you ethically put something on the table such as this, which took, for me, 3 weeks of trying to understand it, and I have a base knowledge of it. It doesn't remove the fact that I pick a special use for something that has never been done here. Makes the most sense because it not only checks all the boxes of all the other mosquitoes, it checks all the boxes of the state and federal regulations that are already in existence. And it marries that with our process of seeing something that has never existed slowly exist so that the floodgates don't open and 1,000 people all do it. We know that's not going to happen. But if we're going to treat this and be small business friendly, I think we also have to be family friendly and understand that, yeah, it's going to be, this is a PR campaign. You have to educate people on not only what he does, but why he's asking for it. And if it's just to save a couple $100 a month on rent, that's a different topic altogether. So if that's why we're doing this, just to save a couple $100 on rent, maybe we should look at finding some spaces in already established manufacturing district type businesses that have smaller units. This isn't something where we can go, oh, well, he wants to save money on rent, that's why we're going to do this. I understand everything you're saying. It does not, for me personally, just me, does not remove the idea that I would prefer to keep it in manufacturing districts, but I understand what he does, and I understand that, yeah, as you get older, you don't need the huge warehouse. I get all that. But that's why I'm comfortable meeting you in the middle at the special use. I'm not comfortable with the home occupation. But that, again, it's just me.
Yeah, the whole special use part is, though, we see so many projects that get killed through that. And it's, people get tired of going through and being beleaguered by residents who just don't want to hear us. And that's the problem, is being business friendly is not putting up walls. Putting up a wall is the special use process, because that allows so many conditions to be added to it. It's not a set of rules. A special use, that's going to be a negotiation on what you're going to do. I mean, you can add conditions to that. I mean, tell me how many special uses you've seen go through that don't have conditions added to it based on whatever the product is, whatever individual it is. So you could have individual A and individual B have two different special uses for the same thing, but because of being special use and what the comments come out, they're different conditions. It's not a fair system. The special use process is not fair because it allows conditional elements to be added to it. So you're not setting up a set of rules that apply to everybody, because it's going to be an individually based and weighted system, and those rules will be different for others.
But those rules apply to everybody, already M1, M2. Those rules apply to everyone, where they have M1, M2.
But is it fair for small businesses? It's really not. Europe has a very high rental rate, lease rate. And I think Lynn could probably talk on that about that our rates are actually higher than some areas around here. I don't want to drive any businesses away. I want to keep them in town. If they're here, I want to keep them here. I don't want to close their doors for me. And that's the problem, is I want businesses to stay open.
So where are we, maybe? We can stay at some kind of recommendation.
I am favoring the home occupation. I think that, well, respectfully understand what Joel's saying. I do want to keep small business here, but he's also above a basic FFL too. I mean, it's a lot harder to get to where he's at than an FFL. So I'm not as concerned about all these FFLs trying to do what he's doing. And as Alderman Punkhauser pointed out, there's several FFLs that are operating out of their homes, which most of them do, with the exception of Gunston, correct? So with that being said.
Can I interject for a second on that one? There should be no FFLs operating our homes in Yorkville. If they are, that is because the ATF did not contact staff in regards to zone. So if there are, I have to contact the ATF to let them know. But at that point, the license is issued and it stays for 3 years. We can't go back. So that's just clarification.
Okay. I know another, there's other towns that permit that. Or permit.
Yes.
Okay. So that's kind of where I'm at with the home occupation.
I'm for the home occupation. The only reason I mentioned special use, I just would like some way that we know. I think we do need to know, like, by something it, or how you want to do that.
Just to be clear on the difference on registration versus licensing, we can require registration and say, if you're going to do this, you have to let us know. But what happens is the teeth on that is when we find out that somebody is doing that without it, it's an ordinance violation, which is then 30 to 40 days away from going to a hearing, which then results in a fine. And eventually you get to a point where maybe a fine is a deterrent, but there is not a revocation of that registration or license like there is with a liquor license. So you can't issue a cease and desist order and tell somebody, I don't want you doing this in your home. You know, I found out that you did it, and so, you know, the registration is then pulled up. So that's the nuance in.
So if we go and we do the check for home occupation, what, okay, I want to do this in my house. What is the process? I would get to come to the city once it's a tech center?
No, there is no process. So to do a home occupation, they just call and ask if it's permitted as a home occupation. And we say, yes, these are the standards. We don't keep a record of who's doing what as a home occupation. We don't know who has home occupations. We don't charge a fee. And if there is a violation of a home occupation, it's a zoning ordinance violation, so it's the same process Bart just mentioned. We can't necessarily stop it.
But if you do the special use, we're going to have to notify people within a certain amount of area of the home, so that it's going to make the neighborhood aware. And I like the special use because it's a process, and if you're serious about it, you're going to go through it. It's going to get on our radar. It's going to get on the neighborhood's radar. Some people complain, could be, maybe not. Everybody, you know, how many people have bunches of the house these days? So that's going to be the time. You know, if something happens, it's home occupation happened, and something happens, somebody does this, they're not reputable, is that going to come back and say, well, how did you allow that? How come we didn't know our neighbors? Like, you know, I like the special use.
So with the special use, isn't it also, sure, the neighbors can get up and complain, but that doesn't have any impact on the fact that a majority of elected officials have to approve it. That's it?
No.
So right now, you've already got two people here that are in favor of the home amendment, two that are for the special use. I don't think this is something where we have to say, well, if one of us don't agree with it, then it doesn't apply. But I also think we have the procedure for the special use in place. These bugs are getting bigger. Since we have a procedure for the special use in place, and none of us are not in favor of the business activity, I don't see why it might take an extra 15 to 45 days, but your process already takes. So it's like, if you've already jumped through these hoops, this isn't going to be the hoop that puts you out of business or kills you. And like, I understand the idea of being small business friendly, but I don't like the idea of setting something up so that something can just happen without the people around knowing about it. That's it. I don't think that people's opinions on what you're going through as far as special use matter when it comes to facts. We're talking about logic, we're talking about emotion. I tend to kind of defer to logic. 99% of things. This is one where you have to allow people the opportunity to express concern, even if it's not based on fact. That's what we kind of have to do in this process, in my opinion. Again, I'm just one person. I think it makes more sense to, yes, it's going to be arduous, it's going to be annoying. I get it. People suck. Well, the alternative is just to keep doing what you've been doing. So I don't see the special use as being too restrictive. And I honestly don't think that the special use is something where things go to die in special use. I don't see that as being the outcome.
This would be different than if you're in a bunch of townhomes somewhere, you would have everybody else said. That's true. I agree with that part.
So what should we do?
Yeah.
No. Okay.
In terms of regulation, I think there is a clause with the state that says that the FFL requires you to be in compliance with all local regulations. So, in terms of enforcement, while we may not be able to enforce it other than with our local adjudication, work with the state in order to deal with violations. Because if there's a violation of a local regulation somebody's doing locally, then that sets it up for the state to be able to act more or less on our behalf from a complaint. Does that make sense?
I understand the concept. In practice, I have no idea if or how it would work. I haven't thought through it.
Do you have something to investigate? Because if that's the case, then there would be a method for us to work with the state who really controls this.
We can see if we can find somebody. I'm looking to Christy. Christy, you haven't talked to anybody yet about that type of a process, have you?
I did talk to an ATF agent that dealt with this. So from the ATF's perspective, like I mentioned, if they call and verify that they can't locate their local, they won't issue the license. But if they don't call and verify and they issue the license is issued and it's still good for 3 years.
So I guess the nuance here is, who would we call and what would they do if we put in a requirement that said, I don't know, you can only sell 11 guns a year or something, and we find out that somebody's selling 13 under the home occupation process, or another example that's better than that, and we choose not to do anything other than issue the ordinance violation, do you think that the ATF or somebody from the state or state police or whatever the enforcement agency is would then turn around and take up our local issue because they're in violation of the federal license because they're not in compliance with the local?
No, I don't think so.
Is that something we
can
confirm? Yeah, we can ask, yeah. We can ask.
Because the state police would be the ones, since that's the one that just recently set 2019 or 2017 rules on this one where they have registry for Illinois. So theirs are restricted. And if that does affect meet that criteria of local compliance, then they would put in local compliance if there wasn't a means to enforce it. So if that's at the state police and them having to actually enforce it, well, so be it. We could utilize that, I would think, as our enforcement mechanism.
Well, part of the opinion is the last.
Well, I think we're all four of us. I just don't know the best way.
Because we know we get that, and I have no problem with that in this business, but we don't know who else could come up with this. And I think if we do the whole occupation, we lose control to a certain degree. Yes, there's, I get all this, you know, the ATF and all that good stuff. But I think people in the neighborhood.
That's what I was wondering.
Well, I mean, we could put anything within the ordinance. You know.
They have to be a number 7 or something?
Yeah, yeah. Correct. You know, to permit it as a whole occupation. Well, that's, yes.
That's my question.
That's the issue. So, in your packet, staff did prepare that you were looking for home occupation, and the regulations are that they have to have a federal firearms license, they have to have the state license, and they can't manufacture ammunition for retail sale. And the other criteria that affects it is that you can't have more than one outside person that doesn't live in your home as an employee, and that it can't take up more than 25% of your gross floor area, total area of your home. But again, we don't know who's doing home occupations. On occasions, we get canceled home occupations if it's on a, you know, they're advertising and on a website or something, you get information that way or a complaint. But otherwise, if there's no complaint and no outward information, we don't know what's happening with home occupation.
I feel like you lose a little bit of control over that. So we have to come up with something here. Any suggestions? Anything that we're can we take it out to the rest of the council?
The committee can choose whichever direction they want.
Yeah, I get it.
Sure.
Okay, so we can prepare generally the same materials and then just update them that say we had two committee members recommended as a home occupation, perhaps with some, you know, tightened language, and then two committee members that asked for special use, and they decided to throw it up to the greater group for a vote.
And you would put down there that the four committee members do support the business?
Yeah, oh, of course, yes. So, and just to be clear, too, Christy, you had drafted some language within the ordinance, correct? So,
correct, for a home occupation.
Okay, so we haven't done it yet for the special use process, correct?
Correct, and what we would do for the special use process is probably the same criteria for a home occupation.
Okay.
And then ask them to provide us with a business model of what it is that they're going to be doing.
Okay, so we have, I'll say, the 80% language on either choice, depending on which the city council gives direction on. But it still would require us to draft the 100% language that the city council has to vote to initiate the zoning code amendment that would then do the public hearing and then the ultimate city council approval. So that would be the next step is, you know, have the group of eight decide one way or another. We can finalize the language at that point and then have you vote on it to initiate the zoning code amendment.
So just to clarify, making this a special use requires a public hearing, and then each application for special use requires a public hearing specific to that individual.
Yes, and also making it a home occupation will require a public hearing because it's part of the zoning code, isn't it, Christy?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. It would be an amendment to the zoning code.
So, yes. So the idea that the public hearing is going to kill this, well, the first public hearing anyway, it's the second one, which if it was, would the public hearing on the special use and the specific special use public hearing happen at the same time?
They can.
Yeah.
So that's one public hearing.
So we would have a public hearing on either act. We could have one on either option.
Correct, yes. Either solution that you are recommending requires a zoning code amendment, which in itself requires a public hearing and then authorization by city council, both to initiate the process and then to close it out by actually approving it. So if you do decide that you're going to make it a special use process and that starts, we could have any petitioners that are interested file their material and then it can go along, you know, in parallel with the actual zoning.